Talk long enough about where to draw the line between science and pseudoscience, and you'll eventually bump into questions about the paranormal. Life after death, UFOs, telepathy, that kind of thing. Scientists often bristle at these subjects, but Hollywood certainly doesn't.
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition.
They're here.
I see dead people.
Who are you gonna call?
Someone else.
You ain't got a body no more, son. It's all up here now. You wanna move something, you gotta move it with your mind. You gotta focus. You hear what I'm saying?
What I am is telepathic. I can hear people's thoughts.
When I was a little boy, my grandmother and I could hold conversations entirely without ever opening our mouths. She called it shining.
What would you do if they actually landed?
Well, I mean, first contact is a big responsibility, isn't it?
They come in peace, we go to pieces.
That's not how I roll.
No.
E.T. Home phone.
Our mission is to monitor extraterrestrial activity on Earth. We work in secret. We exist in shadow.
And we dress in black.
This house is bad, Mommy.
Michael, honey.
There's no bad houses. There's just bad people.
It's not the house. It's me. You know, wherever I go, it goes.
No one there!
It's a language, all right. It's English.
What do you mean, English?
That's English in reverse. Listen.
If the human sacrifice is impure, the result may still be attained, but the demon will forever reside in the soul of the victim. She must forever feed on flesh to sustain the demon.
Okay.
She's eating boys!
It doesn't work if you don't believe.
The paranormal is great fodder for movies. But should we take any of it seriously? That's the question journalist Steve Volk explores in his book Fringeology. Volk is a veteran journalist, a longtime staff writer for Philadelphia Magazine, and a contributor to Rolling Stone, The New Republic, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Steve Paulson wanted to know why he took on this topic.
You know, this is a subject that's usually not good for the reputation of a journalist who writes for mainstream publications. Why did you want to write a book about the paranormal?
I kind of felt compelled. I had no choice. I had grown up as a kid with a family ghost story, and it was something I'd sort of shoved to the back of my mind over the years, but it was always sort of there, kind of gnawing at me that I'm a professional storyteller, and yet telling this story would be verboten, not something I'm supposed to do. And that seemed really curious to me. It seemed to me like the stigma against sharing this sort of story was something that needs to be broken.
Well, you know, I think we actually need a definition here. What do you mean by the word paranormal?
It's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people take the paranormal to mean supernatural and somehow beyond the reach of science. To me, something paranormal could be a phenomenon that science simply hasn't explained yet.
So the supernatural for you basically refers to God or the devil or spirits or something like that, which almost by definition is beyond the realm of science, whereas the paranormal is something quite different. In fact, it might have nothing to do with religion.
Yeah, exactly. And look, it could be that God will one day be accessible by science, but there's no godometer as of yet, you know. So God could turn out to be a paranormal question rather than a supernatural one. We'll have to see.
And so you're saying that in terms of paranormal phenomena, and by that I assume you're talking about things like telepathy or the question of whether there's life after death, ghosts, that kind of thing.
Right.
You're saying these things can be investigated scientifically.
Right. I have to tell you, one of the things that really shocked me writing Fringeology, I'd gotten so used to over the years hearing that there was no evidence for psychic phenomenon. But in fact, there's treasure troves. There's hundreds of papers, well-researched papers appearing in, you know, peer-reviewed journals by well-qualified researchers that show a very small telepathy that all of us hold.
give me an example or maybe a couple of examples of these.
Well, it would be a situation like where if you're expecting somebody, if they have four different cards and they're turned face down on the table and they know what the four symbols are and they're supposed to guess which symbol is going to be pulled at any given time, you would expect them to be right one out of every four times by chance. Well, many, many studies on this subject, it turns out people are right, say, 28% of the time, 30% of the time. This may not sound like much, and it could be, you know, within the realm of chance to hit at that high a level, except that they do such a huge number of trials that it virtually eliminates that as a possibility. So the question becomes, what's going on? To me, a truly rational person who comes into this and looks at the evidence would have to say, wow.
And yet I would think the more convincing kind of evidence would be if someone is reputed to have true psychic powers, that person would get the answer right at least 50% of the time, maybe even more if you can sort of have that remote viewing capacity.
There are some examples of people who've been able to score at really high rates. There's a guy named Sean Harabance who I get into in the book. I haven't been able to test him myself, but he has been tested a number of times and he scores at a really remarkable rate of consistency. And even more impressively for his credibility, you've never heard of him. He doesn't go on television. He doesn't do a lot of interviews. He refused once he found out I was a reporter to see me. And it's because he feels that he has a gift and that he sort of demeans it by getting involved with commercializing it. But he does, anybody who wants to test him scientifically, he'll go.
Now, you say covering the paranormal is fair game for a journalist. In fact, it's surprising that more reporters don't cover this subject, that it can be covered like any other subject.
In the journalistic vernacular, this is low-hanging fruit, right? You're talking about life-changing events for the people who believe they've experienced them. And they have, you know, tremendous dramatic scenes in them. For instance, in my chapter on UFOs, I met with a guy named Ricky Sorrells, who claims to have seen a massive craft so big hovering just a few hundred feet above his head that he could not see from one end of it to the other. And it was completely silent. And he stood there for several long minutes looking at it before it shot up and out of sight with a speed he says that there isn't a word for. That's great material to work with as a writer. I mean, I had a gas writing that scene.
Can you do anything more than just trust him? I mean, don't you need some sort of corroboration to give the story legs?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's the Stephenville Lights is what we're talking about here, ultimately. And he claimed that several weeks before there was a mass sighting, he had had this solo sighting. And it did correspond with what some police officers in town said they saw. So there were a lot of people reporting the same sort of craft in Stephenville over the same period of time. And the day of the big sighting, the January 8th, 2008 sighting, when dozens of people, I like to say they had the great misfortune of looking up because they had no idea that when they saw something in the sky they couldn't explain. I mean, look, that's a UFO, right? An unidentified flying object. They're not saying it was an ET spacecraft. But in our culture, we've completely equated the two. To me, there should be no shame in saying you've seen something in the sky that you can't identify. So anyway, to get back to Ricky, what I think gives him some more credence is that all these people saw it on January 8th, and the Mutual UFO Network came in, and they did issue a Freedom of Information Act request on the radar data from that day. And it came back that there was, in fact, an object that had no transponder, that was flying very, very slowly at some times and very fast at others, at average speed of less than 50 miles an hour, sometimes accelerating to over 500 miles an hour. Radar scatter couldn't explain this over the course of an hour. There were a few eyewitnesses whose testimony, you know, corresponded exactly to that radar track. That does not mean it was ET. And too often our knee-jerk reaction when we hear a report like this is just to laugh.
You mentioned earlier that what got you into the subject originally was a family ghost story.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I hate telling the story. Well, look, I was about 6 years old when it happened, and I have, you know, this sort of vague fragmentary memories of it. So what I did is I interviewed family members about it. The story they told me is that there was a loud banging or booming sound that would happen only in the middle of the night in our house, late at night when everybody was asleep, would wake everybody up out of bed. And to my sisters on one side of the upstairs, it sounded like it was coming from up in the walls of their room. To my brother and I across on the other side of the house, it sounded like it was hitting on the roof over our heads. My sisters claimed worse things were going on. They claimed that their bed shook in the middle of the night. They claimed they saw a woman walk through the middle of the room and out of a closed door. My parents rejected that side of things. Not necessarily that even that they didn't believe them. As my father put it to me, well, we didn't want to believe them. So they looked into the noise. And what was interesting is that, you know, the first thing I'd leap to, right, is a water hammer, some sort of problem with the plumbing in the walls, or the house settling. But we're talking about a sound that would go on for long minutes, tens of minutes, that would go away in the middle of the night and come back. It did not fit with a water hammer, which involves that, you know, that sudden stoppage of water flow. They went upstairs and they tried to recreate it by opening and closing closet doors, banging on different walls. Finally, they thought, well, maybe this really is a ghost. So we were practicing Catholics at the time. And my dad went to the family priest and told him what was going on. And the family priest said, well, usually in cases like this, I'll come over and just do a house blessing. So he came over and he blessed the house. And he threw holy water in all the corners. And I can still remember him coming in. It was a big dramatic deal. When he left, he said, all right, Jerry, that's my dad's name, I'm sure everything will be fine. Only that night, everything wasn't fine. That night, the noise actually got worse. It went on longer and louder than ever before. And we ran downstairs, the kids. We were scared. My parents, of course, were already awake, and they were starting to think about leaving the house for the night. When suddenly the noise did something it had never done before, it hit at a specific point. Like, instead of coming from this amorphous place upstairs, it hit at the landing at the top of the stairs, and then it came down one step at a time. My dad describes it as sounding like a child throwing a tantrum, hitting every stair as hard as it could. And then when it got to the bottom, that was it. We never, ever heard it again, whatever it was.
Okay, so it's quite a story.
I'm with you, right? So, now look, what am I supposed to do with that?
What do you make of that?
Well, it makes no sense. It's so remote from my daily experience that I don't really know where to put it. Here's the thing, though. I don't think there is really anywhere to put it at this point. And what I mean by that is the standard skeptical explanation of creaking floorboards and superstition just doesn't apply to this. Hoaxing doesn't apply to this because we were all under observation by each other, you know what I mean, at various times when this was going on. So what was it? We don't know. And that doesn't mean that there are immaterial spirit beings that exist among us. It just means we don't know.
That's a fascinating intellectual stance to take, because you're saying that maybe some of these things really do happen, but science can't explain them. So then the conclusion is that perhaps science is not the gauge to measure all of what's real.
I think the one thing we'd say for sure, right, it's not the gauge to measure everything that's real at this very moment in time, most likely, because it never has been before, right? Science is always finding new methods, new means, new technologies, and discovering more and more about the world. Have we reached the pinnacle? Have we reached the end of that? Probably not. And so why not just take the stance that we don't know what this was right now and sort of enjoy that? For me, when I came to the conclusion that on both sides, the people who are so quick to label these things ghosts, you know, deceased spirits from someone who's lived before, and the people who are so quick to label this superstition and evidence of our gullibility, are both kidding themselves, right? They're both sort of seeing the world as they expect to see it, seeing the world as they take it to be. The truth is, we don't know.
Steve Volk is a staff writer for Philadelphia Magazine. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't.